You are listening to the Political Periscope, a weekly podcast brought to you by Radio WNET. Interviews on international politics, security, geopolitics, economy, and more. Every Thursday at 7 p.m.
Today's guest of the Political Periscope is Jakub Olchowski, PhD, head of the Eastern European Department in the Institute of Central Europe in Lublin.
Political Periscope.
Has the Ukrainian counteroffensive started?
Yes, of course. It started last week, but some time ago. Because what we could see during the last few weeks, at least, I think, it is a counteroffensive. But of course, it's not a counteroffensive that probably many people, many observers could expect. Because there was so much noise about this upcoming counteroffensive. I think that from the beginning of this year, many people, many experts, politicians, public opinion in different countries, they talked about Ukrainian counteroffensive on and on. Ukrainians, on the other hand, the political elites of Ukraine, they realize how much is at stake. And how important is this counteroffensive for Ukraine? At the same time, they realize that Ukraine has no resources, enough resources, human resources or equipment resources, etc., to organize, you know, something big, something an offensive, a kind of we know from World War II, for example, with millions of soldiers, thousands of tanks and aircraft, etc., etc. Ukraine is not able to do it. And Ukraine has to do something for many reasons, to keep up the morale of the nation and to show to the West, it's very important, to the Western societies and to the Western governments, to the Western elites, that Ukraine is strong. Because if Ukraine doesn't show anything like this to the West will be, and it's inevitable, I'm afraid, the support for Ukraine from the West, which is the support is absolutely necessary for Ukraine to fight this war and to win this war. If war is if it prolongs, I think that the support from the West will be lower and lower, and this enthusiasm for supporting Ukraine will be decreasing. So this is why Ukraine has to do something. And I think that this counteroffensive is ongoing. As I said, it started weeks ago, but it's not a traditional offensive, as we said. Now, it's first of all, in my opinion, it's hybrid counteroffensive because we could see, drones attack on Moscow. We can see every day, almost every day, some burning facilities in the territory of the Russian Federation. We could see the raid of this Russian forces fighting on the side of Ukraine on the territory of the Russian Federation. It's typical hybrid warfare. And this is what Ukrainians, I believe, have learned from the Russians. From the Crimea annexation, from the Donbas operations in 2015 and 16. I think this is the way the Ukrainians are going to conduct this counteroffensive. Of course, with some military operations that are also are being conducted right now. But what is important, I think we should take a look at this and think about it. Ukrainians are very careful about information campaign, about informations about this counteroffensive. I think it's not a coincidence because so far before they have been informing about many things. Now it's silence.
So what are the main goals of this ongoing offensive?
We don't know that exactly because I think it's not many people even in Ukraine know what is the plan, what is the strategic plan, because as I said, there is a lot at stake, so it must be kept secret, of course. But I believe that these hybrid operations will be continued. Will be continued all the time to make an impact on Russian morale, on political and social situation in Russia, which is not very very good, in fact, this situation. And on the other hand, speaking of the military operations, of course, I don't think it's Ukraine will try to push out all the Russian forces from the Ukrainian territory, because I don't think it's possible right now. I think this will be more of a maneuver war and a lot of strikes or limited operations at some directions, not of course not along the all the front line, because all the front line between Russian and Ukrainian forces is about 1,400 kilometers long. That is, this is impossible to make a breakthrough along such a long front line. So I think there will be limited strikes, isolating Russian forces, Russian units, psychological warfare, diplomatic campaign. This is another thing we can see. Both President Volodymyr Zelensky and all the diplomacy, Ukrainian diplomacy, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, etc., etc. They travel a lot, they appeal to different countries, they try to show the Ukrainian point of view in different parts of the world, especially in these parts of the world that are not very supportive of this Ukrainian point of view. So I think this is altogether, this is what we may call a Ukrainian counteroffensive.
Speaking about those parts of the world which are not very supportive of Ukraine, we've observed the visit of some African states leaders in Kyiv, and they denied, in a way, the attack that was ongoing during their visit.
Yeah, that's quite strange. It's not good from the Ukrainian point of view, because you know, there may be some doubts suddenly that Ukrainians say about Russian attacks on Ukrainian territory, on Ukrainian cities, including the capital city, the Kyiv, and some guests from the outside come and they say no, there is no attacks. I don't get the point why it happened. Perhaps they didn't see, they couldn't observe these attacks, or maybe, and I think it's quite a probable scenario, they expected something different. Perhaps maybe they expected something like, you know, World War II air raids with thousands of Russian aircraft dropping bombs, 1,000 bombs on Kyiv. Of course, it doesn't look like this. These are single rocket, usually a single rocket drone attacks. And of course, in a city like Kyiv, which is a couple of million metropolis, you don't have to see, to hear all the attacks that take place, depending on where you are in the city. But so it looks strange in any way.
Especially during the day when there is traffic and much noise. You've mentioned decreasing support for Ukraine, for military aid for Ukraine. We can also observe it even in Poland, especially now that the election campaign is starting. We even have some openly pro-Russian political forces, although they are very, very small. Fortunately.
Yeah, in Poland they are very, very, very small, so far, at least. But yeah, this is, you mentioned the elections. Yes, we have election, parliamentary election in Poland this year, this autumn. But Poland is not the only country to hold election in the this year, so the election will be in different countries on different levels. And, of course, Russia tries to take advantage of this. Russia tries to promote pro-Russian forces, not only in Poland, in many countries, in many places, but it's nothing new. Russia has been doing it for decades, in fact. For example, if we look back to the 80s, suddenly in the Western Europe, we had in the 80s a development of Pacific anti-war movements. Obviously, they were supported and they were financed from Moscow. Now we know that, it's not a secret. And it was, of course, strictly connected to NATO, to American missiles installed in the Western Europe. So suddenly the anti-war movements appeared back then in the Western Europe. Now it's a very similar situation. So Russia uses again the same instrument, the so-called anti-war movements, including in Poland. They are not anti-war movements, in fact. They are pro-Russian. Even if these people who participate in these movements don't believe it or don't know it, that they are pro-Russian. They are, in fact. They are not anti-war. They are pro-Russian. And of course, Russia will, I think, will keep up this policy.
Is there an effective way to counter it?
Information. We have to inform people. We have to, you know, knowledge and education. Unfortunately, I can't see any other effective tool, effective instrument. You know, the problem is, and Russia knows that very well, that the West is democratic. If the West is democratic, it means that we have many freedoms. For example, freedom of speech. So you can say whatever you want in the West. You can establish whatever movement or a political group you want. You can promote any opinion you want, etc. And of course, Russia uses this feature of the Western civilization. What is important, it's impossible vice versa. There is no freedom of speech in Russia, so we cannot use the same instrument in Russia. We cannot, for example, promote establishing anti-war movement in Russia or democratic movement in Russia, because they will go to jail. We cannot send to jail people who are pro-Russian, because we are democratic, and you know, you can have different opinions, different views in democracy. That's the problem.
So maybe the democracy is not the best system in times of war.
It was said many times during the war, strong ruling elites are better, but I don't believe we should take it as granted. Well, take a look at Putin. Is he really so effective as a strongman and as a dictator during a wartime? I don't think so. He's effective, and even Russians, especially Russian political and financial elites, can see that.
Here in Poland, already three times, there's been the Congress of the People's Deputies of Russia, and those Russians who want to create a temporary parliament after the Putin. What are the perspectives of Putin's fall and of changing the political system in Russia?
To be honest, I'm not very optimistic about it. Well, I mean that there will be a change of a person who is in charge. Yes, there will be a change, because Putin is considered more and more to be weak. And in Russia, you cannot be in charge if you are weak. They need someone strong. So probably sooner or later, Putin will be replaced. But I do not think, unfortunately, that he will be replaced with someone who is a Democrat, who is a liberal, and who will try to change Russian mentality, to step away from thinking in terms of imperialism. I'm afraid it's not going to happen. I'm afraid that if Putin will be replaced by someone, it will be again someone similar to Putin.
Those visible tensions between Prigozhin and Wagner's group and the Ministry of Defense, Putin himself, do you think they are real, or is it some game, some theater?
Probably both. I think that both. There are, of course, a lot of tensions within the Russian elites, financial elites, political, military elites. And this is a symptom of these tensions. But anyway, we should notice one thing. There is a lot of tensions. There is a lot of criticism. But President Putin is never criticized. He's not the one who is criticized. The elites, they fight between each other. They criticize each other, etc. But they do not attack Putin. And that shows, I think, the real nature of this political system. You cannot criticize, you know, the Tsar. Because Tsar, no matter how weak he is, he still has all instrumentarium to punish you. So yes, there is a fight, you know, dogfight between elites and within the elites. But I think it's a mistake of the West to think that it will change the Russian system.
In the last days, one of the well-known prominent American newspapers published on Instagram photos from Belgorod region telling a sad story of poor Russian civilians under Ukrainian pounding. And there is this problem, there is this question of Ukrainian attacks on Russian soil, Ukrainian attacks on cities. Not all the rockets, not all the UAVs hit their targets, right? Some of them hit civilian buildings, and there is always a question, should we support it? Is it good that Ukraine is also attacking Russian civilian people?
But it's not Ukraine that attacks Russian civilian people. This is this hybrid warfare conducted right now by Ukraine. But if we look back to 2014, 15, 16, it was exactly the policy and the modus operandi that was used by Russia, who was fighting Ukrainian army in Crimea and in Donbas. Not Russians. Separatists, people from Ukraine, from the separatist regions, and it's exactly the same this time. There is no Ukrainian army on the Russian territory. They are Russians. They are Russians, so what's the problem? Just like in 2015, Russia claimed there were no Russian forces on the ground in Ukraine. It's the same. What's the problem? There are no Ukrainian forces in Russia. And speaking of drones and etc. And some attacks. Well, who started the war? It's Russia that started the war. And Russians are never felt for years, for decades. They didn't have a war at home, at their own territory. And now they are very surprised that, this is us. In our territory, drones explode, we had some aerial attacks, etc., etc. This is, again, a part of a hybrid warfare. This is a psychological warfare in this case.
And there's also one argument often used by Russians and, pro-Russian states. For example, in Africa, it's very common to blame the West for colonialism and praise Russia as anti-colonial state that had never colonized Africa or South America. Also, the Western crimes against humanity, war crimes, are brought up as an argument why the West is bad and Russia is maybe not so bad as it appears.
Take a look at the map of the world and at Russia, especially. And take a look at the map of Russia from, 15th or 16th century. How big was Russia in the 16th century and how big was, for example, as the Soviet Union in the 20th century. Well, by the way, it's still the biggest, the largest state on this planet. And do you really think that it was peaceful? Russia was able to grow so big peacefully? No, it was conquer. Of course, the West did a lot of bad things and committed a lot of sins. Yeah, that's right. But of course, it's not true that Russia is in any way better than the West. And you know, this thinking in some part of Africa or Asia or South America, the thinking about the West in terms of colonialism and about Russia in terms of anti-colonial attitude is, of course, a part of the Cold War heritage, because this is the narrative that the Soviet Union used, trying to find the allies in South America, in Africa, in its fight rivalry against the West. So it's not surprising that they still coming back to this narrative and coming back to this story that the West is bad because it's colonial, oppressive. And Russia is good because Russia fights for, you know, the right of nations to self-determinate and etc., etc. It is, of course, not true. It is a story figured out by the Soviets and now continued by Russia. But this story is very popular in many places.
We can even see it during those congresses of nations of the post-Russia, as they call them, free nations of post-Russia, and the nations that are held in this so-called prison of nations, as Russian Federation is.
Yes, of course, this is what we said just before a second. The Soviet Union was called the prison of nations, but the Tsar's Russia also. Russia was always a very oppressive state. We know that because we are neighbors of Russia, but we have to realize that many nations in many different states, countries, continents, they don't have such a vision of Russia. You know, for example, in India, people say, it's not our war, this is your European war. You Europeans, you started World War I, you started World War II, and now what? Are you trying to start World War III? It's not our problem. This is your problem, your Europeans. We don't want to have anything in common with it. And we remember what West did to us. And we remember that the Soviet Union helped us. This is a perspective of many countries, and we have to consider it to realize this is their point of view.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This was The Political Periscope. The podcast is released every Thursday at 7 p.m.